From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are Nancy Marshall Genzer, senior reporter for Marketplace, and Katherine Gibson, VOA congressional correspondent. Welcome, Nancy and Katherine.
Hello.
Thank you so much.
Well, here are the issues. President Joe Biden set a new vaccination goal to deliver at least one shot to 70% of adult Americans by July 4th as he tackles the problem of winning over the doubters and those unmotivated to get inoculated. The president also faces formidable battles to pass the rest of his legislative agenda on Capitol Hill. What will Democrats need to do to pass trillions of dollars in legislation? Republicans in the House of Representatives have moved to expel Congresswoman Liz Cheney of the western state of Wyoming from their leadership ranks for rejecting Donald Trump's claim that he won the 2020 election. Facebook's quasi-independent oversight board upheld the company's suspension of Donald Trump when he was president, but said the company was wrong to make the suspension indefinite and gave it 6 months to determine a proportionate response. In London, foreign ministers representing the group of seven industrialized nations met this week to discuss a range of world issues. The three-day meeting of the G7 in London was heavily billed as a chance to restart face-to-face diplomacy and an opportunity for the West to show a united front against threats from China and Russia. India's health ministry reported over 412,000 new coronavirus cases across the country. Here in the U.S., the Food and Drug Administration is expected to authorize Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children aged 12 to 15 this coming week, setting up shots for many before the beginning of the next school year. Well, these are the issues, and let's get started. Nancy, I'll start with you. President Biden called for states to make vaccines available on a walk-in basis and is directing pharmacies to do the same in order to have 70% of adults vaccinated by July 4th. How aggressive is this goal? And since it is not mandatory to get the vaccine, how will he convince people to do it if they don't want to?
Yeah, I think the Biden administration is realizing we're probably not going to get to herd immunity where we have a majority of people vaccinated. But right now they're focusing on adults who maybe need a little more convincing, trying to get shots to their doctor's office so their personal physician could administer it. Also people who maybe have just put off having a shot, maybe they can't get time off from work, and adolescents aged 12 to 15. As a mother of twin 12-year-old boys, I am very interested in that announcement from Pfizer. I think the idea there is to try to get school going in person across the country this fall without any wrinkles.
Also, Katherine, with already more than 56% of American adults receiving at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, and nearly 105 million are fully vaccinated. So I'll actually pose the same question to you. How is Biden going to convince people to get this vaccine?
Well, I think he has a long road ahead of him now that the kind of the core group of Americans who already knew that they were going to be getting the vaccine, that they were open to that, now they have to move and convince that other group of people who may say, you know, look, I don't think that COVID-19 is as much of a threat to me as the possibility of taking what they say is an experimental vaccine. So, you know, you need to convince some Americans that they're, when they're weighing these costs, they're not just thinking about their own individual health. They're also making a decision by not getting that vaccine about the overall health in the American society and the community, and getting all of us to that herd immunity so that we can get back to normal. That is going to be a very difficult argument for the Biden administration to make, because when we look at who is getting the vaccine, it's mostly in those blue Democratic areas where people are Biden voters. So this is something where we're going to be looking again at the partisan divide in this country, where a lot of the Trump voters are not interested in getting that vaccine. That's going to be a difficult case for Biden and the U.S. government to make.
And also, with more than half of the U.S. vaccinated, how do you all think Americans are buying into President Biden's urging and the mask wearing as the public's patriotic duty, when many states, they're already reducing this restriction for outdoors?
Yeah, we saw Florida Governor Ron DeSantis basically issuing an executive order and signing legislation that prohibits local governments from requiring masking or social distancing. Interestingly, though, that does not apply to businesses like Disney World, for example, can still require masks. But it's really a local decision, a state decision. It's going to be really hard for the Biden administration to enforce that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been interesting here in Washington, D.C., where the mask wearing people were really following that mandate over the past year. Now, as more and more people here, even in Washington, D.C., are getting vaccinated, you see a little bit of a rollback of people wearing the mask at all times. There's kind of this negotiation where people are figuring out what they feel comfortable with as they know that more and more people are getting the vaccine. That's something that each person is going to have to make an individual decision on. And like you said, you know, make that decision on a state and local level.
And especially as an individual on a personal level, people are going to have to make that decision because a lot of people still do not feel safe even though they've been vaccinated.
Absolutely. And I think after a year of mask wearing, it's going to feel a little bit strange for a lot of people here in the United States to finally take that mask off. I think mask wearing for a large part of the population is going to be here to stay for a very long time. It's just something that some people have grown accustomed to. And there's certainly a group of people who believe that they should never take off that mask, that this is something that's kind of the new normal. It's going to be a negotiation as we go on.
And also getting back to local governments, you know, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, said it's okay if you've been vaccinated not to wear a mask outdoors unless you're in a big crowd of people. And yet places like Montgomery County, Maryland, are still requiring a mask when you're outdoors.
Absolutely. So I think mask wearing will be around for a while. And Catherine, Biden's first 100 days are behind him, as we all know, and you've been reporting that he will be facing some formidable battles in getting more legislation passed. So what would you say is Congress' biggest focus right now?
We got, like you said, through those first 100 days, that kind of informal marker of the success of a new presidency. And we know, of course, that the Biden administration moved very quickly to pass new massive coronavirus relief almost immediately after the U.S. Senate had organized itself. That, of course, was an urgent priority. And now that they've got that off their plate, they have a number of priorities that they're going to have to sequence. And really, realistically, they're only going to be able to get one or two of them through before we hit the summer recess, before we start looking at passing a U.S. government budget. And then, of course, here in the United States, everybody is always running for re-election. Once you move into that midterm election cycle, you really aren't going to be getting a lot of legislation done. So the priority list pretty much looks like this: the American Jobs Plan, getting that U.S. infrastructure up to speed with the rest of the world, fixing our roads, our bridges, broadband internet, clean drinking water, better piping. That is the priority right now on Capitol Hill. That's what's under negotiation. But there are a number of other urgent, pressing priorities. Among them, figuring out the nation's immigration system. This has, you know, really been the goal for 30 years for politicians to try and figure out a situation for the 11 million undocumented immigrants here in the United States, give them some sort of permanent pathway to citizenship, and figure out the situation at the border, which is always already becoming an issue for the Biden administration. We also have police reform, which is also being negotiated in the House right now. We know, of course, that last summer, during the height of the protests over the death of George Floyd in police custody, the U.S. Senate attempted to pass police reform. They failed at that. They want to take another swing at it. And as we all know here in the United States, we have mass shootings on a regular basis that renew the calls for some kind of gun control legislation. That said, Democrats are really working with a very slim majority in the U.S. Senate, where they cannot pass much of anything unless they get those 10 Republican votes, or they decide to blow up the filibuster, that kind of level to opening up debates. So we can get into that, but that's really their big obstacle.
Yes, they have some major challenges facing them now and in the months ahead. And Nancy, I wanted to go back to Biden's $1.9 trillion economic relief package that was intended to or is intended to address the COVID-19 pandemic. And it's one of the largest in U.S. history. So how is this package affecting the economy of the U.S.? And does it seem to not be motivating people to want to go back to work? I'm hearing many employers say they are very short-staffed now.
You know, economists differ on that, Kim. Some more conservative economists say, well, of course, people don't want to get back to work if they can sit at home and get employment benefits that are as much as they were making working or even more. But the federal supplement for unemployment ends in September, and it's not clear that it'll be extended. So people realize the unemployment benefits won't last forever. So other economists are saying, look, people know they have to work eventually. If a good job comes up, they will take it. So there's a lot of debate around that.
So I also want to move on to another big story, Catherine. Republican Party leaders and former President Donald Trump are endorsing Congresswoman Elise Stefanik of New York, a staunch supporter of Trump, to replace Liz Cheney, chairwoman of the House Republican Conference, the third ranking party position. So why would you say Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy is encouraging this effort to replace Cheney?
Well, Cheney has been very outspoken since the January 6th Capitol riot that involved pro-Trump protesters attempting to overturn the election results, the counting of election results for eventual President Joe Biden. Cheney has come out and said, look, this is a big lie that the election was stolen from former President Donald Trump. The election did go legally. Joe Biden is the president of the United States, and the former president's actions since then, she has been highly critical of. She has made this stand really pretty much on her own. There were a handful of other House Republicans who did vote to impeach the president for his role in inciting the violence on January 6th. She really, though, is an outlier. She and those handful of other Republicans really are representing kind of a dying breed among Republicans in the U.S. Congress. I think it's a mistake to say that there's a split in the party, because by and large, the party is still a party for Donald Trump. They know that his voters are still there. They still support him. And that's the direction that the party is moving in. That's why Kevin McCarthy was taking a look and saying, look, Liz Cheney no longer represents us Republicans. We need to force her out of leadership for saying these things. And that's why they're going to be almost certainly putting Elise Stefanik in that new leadership position.
Also, Nancy, the GOP, they want to win back control of the House in the 2022 elections. So how is this rift going to affect their chances?
Well, so much of politics, unfortunately, as you know, comes down to money. And Stefanik started out as a very traditional Republican. She was a protege of people like Vice President Cheney. And now she and others have realized they can raise a whole lot of money by supporting President Trump and echoing what he says. Stefanik raised more than $13 million for her 2020 campaign, and that was nearly double what she raised in her three previous elections combined. There is one PAC, a political action committee, that's raising money for people like Liz Cheney, but it's dwarfed by all the money that Trump supporters are bringing in.
Now, Catherine, what are people saying it will mean for the GOP if Cheney is replaced?
Well, it'll mean that Cheney is part of that last kind of dying breed of old school Republican who is trying to find this pathway to saying, look, I really don't like where this party is going. This should not be the party of Donald Trump if we want to survive and make an argument to a broader range of voters. She is really staking this claim to being the opponent to Donald Trump, who has already said that he's going to be campaigning heavily for Republican candidates in the midterms. But if we really look at what the average Republican voter is going to be doing, they are going to be supporting Donald Trump. That is how we are moving forward from here on out. Party is really saying, look, this is something that can no longer be in our House leadership conference. We are the party of Trump, and that's what we're going to be doing moving forward.
Okay, well, we'll just have to follow this story and see how it develops, because it appears to be changing on an hour-to-hour basis. Well, it's time now for a short break. When we come back, we'll look at the ramifications of a Facebook decision, talks of world leaders at the G7 summit, and global COVID-19 update. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Nancy Marshall Genzer, Senior Reporter for Marketplace, and Catherine Gibson, VOA Congressional Correspondent. Well, Nancy, Facebook's oversight board says Facebook was justified in banning then-President Donald Trump from its platform the day after the January 6 riot at the U.S. Capitol, but that it needs to reassess how long the ban will remain in effect. What's your overall take on this rule?
This panel is interesting. It's a 20-member committee, and the thing is, it was set up by Facebook. It's funded by Facebook, so I don't know how neutral it really is. But the interesting thing is, it said, look, to Facebook, you can't keep Trump in limbo like this. You have to make a final decision in 6 months. So it sort of punted this tough, very difficult decision right back to Facebook.
What's your take on this, Catherine? And what is the significance of this ruling for other world leaders?
Well, you know, this is an issue that comes up again and again on Capitol Hill among congressional Republicans who have been alleging for a long time that the social media companies have a liberal bias. And I know that when this Facebook decision came out, they were saying, look, this is the prime example of First Amendment rights being violated by forcing, you know, the former president of the United States, removing him from a platform and removing his First Amendment rights. Now, from a Democratic perspective on Capitol Hill, Facebook is a private company. Facebook is able to make its own decisions, its own business decisions about who is allowed on their platform, how they can run things, and that it's not a violation of First Amendment rights, particularly if the former president is inciting violence on that platform. This is something that's going to be brewing on Capitol Hill for a while. There's been a lot of talk about renewing some of those internet laws that date back more than 20 years and are really outdated at this point in terms of what can go on what social media platforms. I think this will further fuel lawmakers to take a new look at those laws and try to, you know, come to some sort of resolution where there's an exchange between free speech and policing a little bit of this internet hate speech, incitement of violence, that kind of talk, so that there can be some kind of compromise reached.
And also, Nancy, as you alluded to earlier, this was Facebook basically making its own rule, if you want to look at it that way. So really, what will this mean for the rest of social media users?
Well, they won't see President Trump on Facebook for 6 months. He's also banned from Twitter, and that is permanent. This has a lot of implications for Trump and his ability to raise money. You know, he would use Facebook quite a bit. You know, he would run polls or send out a message saying, wish Melania a happy birthday, and then that would help the Trump campaign keep their contact lists current and maybe add some new names and some new phone numbers so they could solicit those people in the future for money. So this is a setback for Trump. Could be temporary, though.
And let's look at the G7 summit. Foreign ministers of the G7, they met in London for a three-day meeting to discuss some of the world's top issues. What kind of message do these types of summits send to countries such as China and Russia? And at one time, this was the G8 summit where Russia was invited. Catherine?
Right. Well, I think it's important to remember that this G7 summit is really focusing on the threat posed by China and, to a lesser extent, Russia. You're gathering those nations together, and the real theme of this meeting has been to take a look at how to counter that growing Chinese threat, how to continue to have open and democratic societies. And we know, of course, that President Biden has said that there's going to be a kind of summit on this issue later on in the summer. The date for that has not yet been announced, but this is going to continue to be an issue of concern, particularly when we look at the issue of vaccine diplomacy, which, as we know, China and to some extent Russia are trying to counter U.S. influence by sending their own vaccines abroad. That has been an issue in the U.S. recently with the debate over the vaccine, the TRIPS waiver that the administration just announced that they would be entering into negotiations to lift the patents so that there can be a more free and open circulation of the vaccines to other countries to help build the herd immunity worldwide. Various ways that the U.S. and other nations are looking at maintaining their open democratic societies, making that case worldwide. This is going to be something that's going to be ongoing for a very long time.
Yes, and Nancy, some of the toughest problems leaders are discussing are, first, as Catherine mentioned, the coronavirus pandemic and the whole issue of vaccines, the ongoing violence in Myanmar, the Syrian conflict, and the situation in Afghanistan. So how do leaders prioritize all of these overwhelming issues? And once they make a decision, how is it enforced?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've been looking through the 24-page or 25-page communique they issued at the end of the meeting on Russia. They say, we are deeply concerned about the negative pattern of Russia's irresponsible and destabilizing behavior. They're concerned about Crimea with China. You know, they encourage China to fulfill its obligations under international law with respect to human rights. They mention the Uyghurs. They mention Hong Kong. Yeah, there really is no way to actually enforce all of this. And as far as COVID goes, the communique called for, you know, all nations to pull together and help each other. But again, you know, there's not much concrete here. And the USAID administrator, Samantha Power, hasn't specifically committed to the U.S. sharing more vaccine with other countries.
And with just a few minutes left, Catherine, what is causing this continuous surge of cases in India? And is the international community doing enough to help India?
That has been a real call up on Capitol Hill in recent weeks, particularly among the Indian American caucus, who have been really pushing the Biden administration to send more supplies to India, saying that the U.S. is not doing enough to really help out these other nations. Of course, the TRIPS waiver issue, lifting the patent on the vaccines, is also a part of that discussion. They're saying, look, we are not getting all of these first world countries who kind of bought their way in line to get the vaccine sooner and larger and in larger quantities. Now we need to turn around and we really need to do our part for countries like India, where the suffering under COVID-19 is considerable. We need to make sure that the vaccines get there quickly, because it's in all of our best interest to make sure that a huge country like India is getting vaccinated, is getting to that herd immunity, and is really addressing this serious crisis, this wave of infections that have come along in the past few weeks.
Also, when you look at the bordering countries, the neighboring countries, I'm sure they have very big concerns as well. But worldwide, is this a concern that this could get worse in the coming days?
Absolutely. I mean, if you have people who are not vaccinated, then the virus has a chance to mutate. And we have all these variations. And a lot of the countries that need vaccine have made the point, and India has made this point, that look, if we're not safe, you're not safe.
Here in the U.S., the Food and Drug Administration is expected to authorize Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children aged 12 to 15. You mentioned you have an interest in this. So is there growing concern of cases of the coronavirus growing in this age group?
Yeah, they have been picking up, possibly because of these variants that young people are not as immune to, possibly because people have been not as careful, maybe going to a party without a mask. But also, I think the emphasis is on getting kids back to school in the fall. My kids have started going back to school week on, week off kind of a situation, and they still have to wear a mask all day, except when they're eating lunch and they have to socially distance. It's not a great situation for them. So I think you want to try to get things back to normal as soon as possible.
Right. And I would add that, you know, getting kids back to school will also help with these parents who have been teleworking, working from home for over a year now, helping kind of take some of the burden of childcare. That'll help get things back to normal. It'll help people all around feel that we're really coming out of the coronavirus crisis and getting back to not what used to be normal, but kind of a new normal that we're going to be negotiating as we move along.
You know, just a quick thing, building on what Catherine was saying about kids going back to school, that'll help the economy because you have more women getting back into the workforce.
That's a very good point. And that's all the time we have. I want to thank my panelists, Nancy Marshall-Genzer, Senior Reporter for Marketplace, and Catherine Gibson, VOA Congressional Correspondent. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.